This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
This is AM 950. The voice of Minnesota. Welcome to the program. My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil. You may remember me. I've been on with Matt many times over the years. I actually had a program here at AM 950 years ago. And I have to tell you, sitting in studio again, kind of sort of resting myself back in the chair, in the big chair, just stretching out with you, is something that I'm thrilled to do. Because I have to tell you, I spend my days walking into courtrooms. I spend my days arguing before juries. As a criminal defense lawyer, I'm dealing sort of neck deep in issues of criminal justice and reform and so many other issues on a daily basis, but not in the academic sense, not in the big picture sense. Sometimes it's the minutia piece. It's in the trenches pieces of it that really drive me, but more than drive me, they sort of surround me and sometimes envelop me. And so when Matt asked me to step in, I was pretty thrilled. I was pretty thrilled because you and I, we get to talk about what this stuff means and what's going on in the world and the political aspect, especially of this criminal side, especially of the criminal justice side and about where we're going, is something that I really wanted to dig into for the next couple of hours as I sit in for Matt. And by the way, coming up, when I come back on the 16th, Jerry Blackwell, who was actually the prosecutor who did the openings, some of the direct and cross-examination and the closings in the Derek Chauvin case, he, for the first time, is actually going to come in studio and talk about what it was like to be in the eye of the storm. Now, I want to take you back to May 25th of 2000. That was the day that some have said changed everything. The day that George Floyd was murdered in the street on the corner of 38th and Chicago. Now, I would tell you that that's not true. I would tell you that that's not actually what changed things. And things were changing, and sadly, things are staying the same in many, many ways. Because as I think about this, I recall standing in front of a jury more than a year, maybe 2 years before George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin. And I remember talking about police officers. And I'm standing in front of this jury in Ramsey County in St. Paul, in a St. Paul courtroom. And we were talking about the police. And you could see fundamentally the difference between what a jury looks at when they think about police. Because I can take you back to 20 years ago, again, as a criminal defense attorney and as a former prosecutor. And what you would see at many times in the past was holding up officers as godlike. And I heard that and saw that again, almost to the point that they are above the fray. They're not human. What they do is for society, for humanity. And they would never be questioned. Well, that's not really what I saw 2 years before the death of George Floyd. Now, fast forward to the buildup to the trial after Mr. Floyd's death. William Mitchell School of Law actually started a program. They started a class on the Derek Chauvin trial itself. And I've been thinking about why you would do this. And that's the reason I wanted to bring in Rick Petrie. Rick Petrie is a criminal defense lawyer and has been for many years, although he has a lot of experience doing all sorts of other things too. But he currently serves as the Assistant Director of Career and Professional Development at Mitchell Hamlin. And he joins me. Rick, thank you so much for joining the program.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I think this is a very important and still timely conversation.
Well, I appreciate it because I don't see this as a conversation of what happened in May of 2020. I see this as a question of sort of where we're going. But maybe the first question I have for you is, why did Mitchell Hamlin decide to start a program like this, to start a trial class?
Yeah, you know, after this happened, we had a number of students that took sort of two different positions. One group of students said, this has been so traumatic, because you got to keep in mind that many of our students, you know, live in that neighborhood. And with them, to be at home during the riots, during the time the National Guard was in the street and all of that stuff, was a big deal for them. They're trying to go to law school, but it, you know, they go home and they're dealing with that. So that group of students said, it's too much. We don't want to hear any more about it. We want nothing to do with it. We just wish that it would go away. But at the same time, we had another group of students who said, wow, this is happening right here in our backyard. And there seems to be a lot going on that we could learn from, and we want to walk right into it. And so to accommodate that second group of students, we decided to put together a course so that they could have those conversations, so that they could learn a number of the lessons that came out of that trial. And so we put together the class, and we had it. It worked great.
Rick Petrie is my guest. He's with Mitchell Hamlin talking about not just the Derek Chauvin trial, but really the class that they were building, and maybe a reflection of sort of where we're going in the criminal justice system. But I think these evolving views of the criminal justice system, of law enforcement, of how it all fits together. You're joining me. My name is Jack Rice here on AM 950. You know, Rick, when you think about that, and you think about, you know, starting this program for those two different groups, and I have to tell you, I live 10 blocks from where this happened too. And, you know, I had children in the streets, and it's a really strange It's a strange thing when you see this from a generational standpoint, when you see this shifting, evolving view as it's changing sort of underneath your feet.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this time was different from every other situation like this that I've experienced. You know, like you, I've been around this stuff for a long time. But for the first time, I don't know if it was because of the video or if it was because of the amount of time or the dynamics involved with the murder or what it was, but there was something different about this that literally resonated around the world. You know, I was talking to somebody about it last week, and they said, well, don't forget, it happened during the middle of a pandemic. And so everybody was home. Everybody was watching TV, and everybody was already sort of on edge because of the pandemic, and then we piled this on top of it. And so with all of that in mind, you know, for the first time after this occurred, I had people calling me from different parts of the United States, even people from other countries that I know, saying, hey, I don't know what I can do. I don't know if there's anything I can do, but I just feel like I have to do something. I've seen this happen in the past. It didn't really have a direct impact on me, and I just thought, wow, that's kind of too bad, but it doesn't have a direct impact on me, so I'm going to go on and continue to live my life. But now I don't think I can do that anymore. What can I do?
No, it got me thinking. It got me thinking, you know, Rick, about this, and as I said at the opening, that as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm regularly surrounded by police reports. And so I was in a courtroom about an hour and a half before just this afternoon. And so what you do is you open up a file and you're reading a police report, and everybody in the room may be reading that same report. And you start with that as your jumping off point. And the real question is something you have to start, you ask yourself regularly is this even true? I mean, if we look at what happened with George Floyd, if you look at the initial reports that the Minneapolis Police Department actually put out to themselves about what happened in the street, it simply did not reflect reality. And I think that dichotomy, that space between what they said and what was, that was undeniable, was, I think, it was massive in terms of how it impacted people who watched it, saw it, and then heard about that.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the culture of the Minneapolis Police Department. You touched on this earlier. For those folks to be so brazen to put out that type of a statement that's completely unsupported by fact or reality speaks volumes to the fact that they believed that they could, and that if they did, that it would be just fine. And if you think about it, you take out the video and just have the statements, we're in a whole different place. We don't have riots. We don't have property damage. We probably don't even wind up with a charge. And so that speaks to this issue, and I'm glad you brought it up, because just to be candid about it, this has been an issue for a long time. It's an issue that a lot of people have known about, but that just got kicked down the road over and over and over and over again until the point where it finally reached a boiling point. And so that's what I think we're seeing now. It's like the covers have been pulled back to this reality. I mean, you know, think about it. People don't make those kind of statements if they don't think they can and they can get away with it, right? I mean, come on. You've been around this stuff a long time.
But Rick, come on. Hold on. You and I both know this, that despite all that, despite what we know that the statements were by the Minneapolis Police Department, and then the video and all of the evidence and all of the witnesses, and in fact, not just one video, how many videos do we have now, right? When you start seeing this angle and that angle, plus the vest cams and everything else, all of a sudden you saw a much, much different picture. And yet, nevertheless, we're still seeing that split in society. Those who are saying, duh, we have been fighting this issue for 400 years. And then you will have people on the other side saying, what do you expect the police to do? I mean, look how hard it is for them. If George Floyd had just done this, do you know how bad his record was? All of these different things, those arguments continue despite all of that to come out.
Yeah, they do, and that takes us to, I think, another very important point, which is the American justice system. It's certainly not perfect, but when it works like it's supposed to, it works pretty good. And that means that all the presumption of innocence, the right to a trial, all of those things have to be honored. Otherwise, you just say, well, hey, we pulled this guy over. He was giving us a rough time, and we got tired of it, so we killed him. And that's easy to do when the person who got killed is not tied to you in any sort of way. But you know, just like I do, every single defendant that I've ever represented says, yeah, but it's me, wait a minute. And the families always say, yeah, but it's my son, it's my husband, it's my daughter, it's my wife, it's my whatever. And I want them to have the absolute best defense that they can have. Well, that can only happen. This system can only work when it works, when everybody plays by the rules. Because otherwise what you end up with is you say, yeah, we want the bad guys to play by the rules, but not the so-called good guys. Well, that doesn't work. Everybody's got to play by the same set of rules, or the whole thing goes to heck.
Here's a tough question then. We think about the young woman, that young girl, the 17-year-old, actually saying, this is what I saw. This is why I pulled my phone out. We had multiple other witnesses talking about this on the street on 38th and in Chicago. Without the videotapes and just the statements, right? Just the statements from let's face it, African-American people on this street. And is should that mean something? It shouldn't. But because of that, would there have been a charge otherwise? Your thought?
I doubt it. I really doubt it. I mean, because if you look at that and you look at the dynamics, you've got these statements coming from these young African-American women against the statements of what probably turns out to be a whole bunch of police officers who are going to put up the blue wall. They're going to, and you know this just like I do, they're going to have their meeting after the incident. They're going to say, okay, here's our story. And then that's the story that's going to come out, and they're going to stick together, and they're going to continue to tell that story. And then let's just say that for whatever reason, it's a miracle, and it does get charged, and it goes to trial. Now we run up against this dynamic where we've got the exact opposite of what we saw here, where members of the Minneapolis Police Department actually came out and testified against one of their own. And instead of that, we've got the blue wall of silence. We've got these officers who are standing arm in arm. They're all testifying to the same story against these young African-American women. And you tell me in a Hennepin County jury, who, by the way, almost never looks like this jury look. Let's not forget that. You tell me how that's going to go. And even if you look at voir dire, you know this as well as I do, too. In the old days, you'd ask these members of the jury, if you're trying to figure out bias, you know, are you more inclined to believe a police officer than just any regular person? And most of the time they would say, yeah, I think the police officer is probably telling the truth.
So most of the time? I'll tell you what, Rick Petrie is my guest. Rick, stay with me, because when we come back, I'm gonna talk about the power of that videotape, but I also want to talk about exactly how the prosecution handled the Minneapolis Police Department and really how they characterized themselves as above the fray, as they saw themselves as different than Derek Chauvin, and tried to create as much space as possible, and it just seemed to sit there. There's a lot more to come when it comes to this question of race, law enforcement, criminal justice. Are we different? Are we changing? Are we evolving? Or is it just a lot more of the same? My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil, and this is AM 950. This is AM 950, the Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice in today, sitting in the big chair trying to fill his shoes. Let's face it, it's not going to happen, but I'm here. And it's great to be back in studio, having a program here for years myself and being a guest with Matt so many different times. My guest today is Rick Petrie. Again, he serves as the Assistant Director of Career and Professional Development at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. But we're talking about a course that he's co-teaching or co-taught regarding the Derek Chauvin trial. Again, Rick, thank you so much for staying with me.
Sure, it's good to be here.
Well, and again, I appreciate this, because to me, this question is one that I've always struggled with. And if I look back at this historically, this is the problem that I'm afraid of. Every time we see a police officer act inappropriately, what we get is the one bad apple rule, or at least the one bad apple claim. What you get is the police department will then come in and they'll either do that blue wall where they protect everybody and say, what's the problem? Nothing happened here. And that's the end of it. And typically that is the end of it. Or worse come worse, when they're cornered, what you will get is the one bad apple. This guy was a bad guy. We're great guys, and you have to trust us. He's the bad guy. And the problem that we have is that frequently neither of those options reflect reality.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely correct. You know, let's look at one of the examples. You know, he's the bad guy, we're all good guys. But you can't have one bad guy that's been bad this many times that gets to survive in a culture of good guys, because the good guys wouldn't tolerate it. Let's just be honest about that.
Well, if that's the case, then why, and I'll go straight at it. I'm watching this trial, and I'm watching Chief Arredondo, and I'm watching two of his senior deputies talking about the Minneapolis Police Department. And they're talking about the quality of the department and how this is not how they behave, how they are above this, and that they teach differently, they taught differently, their standards are different, their approach is different, and Derek Chauvin is an outlier. He is not part of who we are. And yet, as you've just described, this wasn't his first run-in. This wasn't his first problem. We understand the number of problems, let alone the $20 million that was paid out to another case just before that, which was record-breaking, and the problems that the Minneapolis Police Department have had again and again and again. And despite what we get, they decided to go with the one bad apple problem.
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated issue. It's, on the one hand, looking specifically at what was going on with the city and, you know, the nation and around the world at this time, they had to come up with something, because the city was on fire. The police had sat down. The mayor had talked about defunding the police department. The president of the city council had said something along those lines. When the police sat down, the crime rate went up. So we got a real mess going on. So we got that stuff happening. At the same time, keep in mind that Arredondo had previously sued the department before he became the chief. So he was aware of this stuff going on. And I think he had tried to make some changes, but I think a lot of this stuff was so deeply embedded in the culture of the MPD, it was very difficult to make those changes. Here's an example. You have these officers that would do bad things, and then they would get written up and go through the civilian review board, and perhaps there's a decision made to fire him. Then the officer goes to arbitration. The arbitrator finds, yeah, probably did something bad, but you can't fire him. Why not? Because you haven't fired anybody else, so you're treating this guy more harshly than you treated everybody else. So now we got this crazy, vicious cycle going on.
They're racing to the bottom, right? So in other words, the standard is, well, because we've got so many bad guys in here and we don't generally do anything with the bad guys, when we find another bad guy, hold on, we have to treat him exactly like we treat the other ones.
Yeah, and that's kind of how it turned out. But I think there's another piece of the puzzle as well, and that is that I think there was a big part of this MPD culture that's just the way it rolled, right? I mean, This isn't the first time that some sort of allegations about Minneapolis police doing bad things have surfaced. That, let's not forget the gang task force, where they had cops, you know, taking property from people. This stuff never wind up even in the property room or getting accounted for. They would just take the stuff home. Now, these are the same people that are supposed to be, you know, seeing about bad guys
right,
that are stealing stuff You know, and so this stuff has been around for a long time. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of it would just get kicked down the road. They would pay out these small settlements and then, you know, be back to business as usual. You know, they had the thumpers too. So this stuff has been around for a long time.
Rick Petrie is my guest here on AM 950. As we think about this, I mean, I can give you examples, and I've had cases of my own, Rick, in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, where I have seen exactly this, where what ends up happening is you'll have officers who may do bad things. And then what will happen is they create this fictional wall between the civil side and what's going on in their professional side. So what I'll have is a criminal case, and I don't even find out about what's happening to them in their employment situation because of all of these bad acts. Because they're saying, ooh, that information is protected because we're doing an investigation. Even if they've made conclusions, they just haven't released them. I, on the criminal defense side, won't know about it. And what I've been told by judges and others is, hold on, there are Minnesota employment protection rights that they have that will trump essentially my right to, the term would be Brady information, information that's bad that I can't get a hold of because it's protected, because these bad guys are protected by employment protections, even though they continue to do those bad things.
Yeah, you know, that's a problem. That's a dynamic that, you know, the law does provide for certain protections for employment information. But at the same time, you know, that those protections have been pushed out so far, just like this pendulum dealing with police unions has been pushed out so far, that what started out, just like police unions, to be something good has been, I'm just going to say it, sort of bastardized. And now has become something that's exploited so much that it causes a lot of problems and allows people to hide behind these things. You know, here locally, police unions started out as a good thing for good police officers because it was to protect them from bad police chiefs that were trying to get them to do all sorts of crazy things. But now that pendulum has swung the other way, and now it's being used in the exact opposite of what it was intended for in the first place.
Well, I am curious, is there an opportunity here? Well, of course, we have to believe there is if we're optimists, and I guess I am, so I want to believe that. And yet, as you were just alluding to earlier, this idea that this was so entrenched, this sort of bad cop mentality, not amongst all of them, because I have some of my dear friends who are police officers, but there is this bad cop mentality that is protected by that thin blue line, that this is simply impossible. And you mentioned the struggles of Chief Arredondo, who got pushed back for that very same reason.
Yeah, I think you know, I'm an optimist just like you, and I do believe that this marks a potential turning point. And I say that for a number of reasons. One, again, just looking back at the trial, for the first time, the chief of police came out. Zimmerman came out. Some of the other officers came out and testified against one of their own. I think there's some political reasons that they did that, but I also think that potentially marks a turning point for doing things in a different way.
Well, now, hold on, Rick. I have to ask, honestly, if there was no videotape, do you really think these guys would have said, you know what, I've decided, it's time to take the high road? Do you really think that they would have done something, dare I say it, inconsistent with what we have seen so many times, if they weren't pushed into a corner and it was impossible to support those behaviors?
You know, I think I'm speculating a little bit, but I'll tell you this. I would have been very surprised if you take out the video if they say those things. But with the video and with the eyes of the world on Minneapolis, on the Minneapolis Police Department, with the DOJ investigation heading this way, I think that it provides fertile ground for a turning point. Now, we'll see if that ends up happening or not. But I agree with you. If you take out the video, I think we're right back to where we talked about earlier. I doubt that there would have even been a charge. But they stayed with that original story. But you put the video into play and you put the eyes of the world on it, I think it provides that opportunity.
If we look back over, and dare I say this, hundreds of years, I know when it's part of your class, part of this issue was to look historically at how we view the police, how we deal with police officers who might actually be on the stand, not as witnesses, but as defendants. Do we find that what happens is we address this problem in a narrow sense, and then you get that reactionary pushback from supporters of the police, just like we're seeing right now about the police will sit down and then crime goes up. We need to unshackle the police. This happened in New York. This happened in Chicago. This happened in Cleveland. This happened across the country. What makes you think, what makes any of us think that as soon as the police have the opportunity, they will continue to do what we have seen historically?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and we're seeing it. We actually saw it in the class where this pushback from members of law enforcement comes, and not just from people that are active in law enforcement or formerly active in law enforcement, but even from those who are strong supporters of law enforcement, where they're saying, hey, you're making it impossible now for the police to do their job. Well, that's not true. That's simply not true. And if we stay on this tack that we're on now with no changes being made, we're really headed for problems. We got the bad guys saying, hey, this is perfect. We got no cops on the street, and so we can do anything we want to. At the same time, we have innocent people who are suffering needlessly, if you ask me, as a result of this. And we've got cops sitting down saying, hey, man, hey, you said you didn't want any cops. So guess what? You got none. How do you like it now? So we can, as a society, we can't continue on that road. And what I'm seeing is a lot of finger pointing, everybody pointing at each other saying, hey, it's your fault that we got here. Well, we can't stay on that either. We have to get beyond that and start having real conversations about how can we do this better in a way that works better for the community as a whole. Because that's I don't see any other way around that. Otherwise, we're really headed for a disaster.
Rick Petrie joins me from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Again, a criminal defense lawyer for many years, plus other things, and we've both been in courtrooms for so long. I think that's a big part of this question. Rick, again, I want you to stay with me, because if I leave it there, there's the part of me that will think that this is hopeless. It's got to be better than that. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about what that means, about how do you fix this? How do you resolve this? Is there a way to address the systemic problem of law enforcement and the failures that we're seeing? Because credibility is a massive piece of this. Without credibility, you're not going to get that support that the police department desperately needs to operate. And if you don't have that, where do you go next? My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil. And I'm actually just here for today. He's on break. What was the term we were going to use, boys? I think it was on assignment. My goodness, I don't even know what that means. Stay with us. A lot more coming up right here on AM 950. You're listening to AM 950, The Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice in with you today. And again, we've had Rick Petrie with us for the hour. I thought it was critically important as we think about where we're going as a society that we understand what this means and why not just race, but the term which I haven't used yet this hour, which is rule of law, the idea that we're all buying in, that a system actually works, a system that is fair to all, that applies to all, that nobody is above, and that what happens if you don't have it, it's a fundamental piece of this issue. And again, Rick, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy. If we look to the future, does rule of law really work if there's a substantial number of people who simply can historically say, hey, it hasn't worked so far, it hasn't worked particularly well, and it doesn't work for somebody who might look like me, what do you say to that?
That's a good question. That's a question that's made me have to pause before I answer it. But I think my answer is I believe in the rule of law. I believe that the rule of law works, but it only works if the rules apply across the board and they are enforced, no matter what. See, there's another dynamic here that we didn't talk about. I'm sure you're aware of it, but that's a dynamic for the county attorney who has to rely on the police department to, so this, for lack of a better way to describe it, to make his bed every day, because you've got to rely on these cops to come in and testify. And if you've got a politician who's relying on getting convictions and tough on crime, all those kinds of things, and you need the cops to help you continue to make that happen, it's pretty hard for you to turn your back on those same people and charge one of them. So That's a problem, but that is the rule of law. That's what the rule of law provides for. I know it's tough, and maybe that's one of the reforms that needs to occur, is that instead of the local county attorney who would normally have jurisdiction over these matters, maybe there's some legislation that says that there is special prosecutors set up to handle these so we can avoid that type of a conflict.
Well, we know that's going on, right? So there have been other circumstances where, for instance, there was an alleged crime committed where somebody was killed by a police officer in, say, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, hypothetically, and that actually was sent over to the Washington County Attorney's Office because they were concerned of, well, at least the appearance of bias and making sure there was an objective decision as to how something like that might be charged.
Yeah, but I think that's a little bit different. That was that coalition between these county attorneys,
right,
where if I'm the county attorney in County A and I've got one here, I pass it off to somebody in County B. And in theory, that should take care of the problem. I don't know all the details. I spoke with somebody yesterday that's a little bit more familiar with the details than I am. But for whatever reason, Keith Ellison, the attorney general, stepped into that one as well. I don't know why, but that's not that coalition is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that's formalized, where there is a special prosecutor available to deal with these types of situations that can come in, doesn't have to worry about these inherent conflicts that a normal county attorney would have to be concerned about.
Do you think that sometimes can work? I mean, I've worked very closely with a couple of county attorneys, and I recall they know, and this is the secret, if you will, they know who some of the bad cops are too. They do. It's like, I don't want to depend upon that guy to take the stand because we know that guy's or that woman is or whatever. And so what we get is the essentially doing nothing about allowing that bad cop to continue on the street, but sort of internally knowing that they're not of the highest caliber.
Yeah, and I agree with you there, but then you've got the other dynamics about, but if we turn against one, then we face this problem of you turn against one of us, you've turned against all of us. And so then you got the cops sitting down, and then now, as a county attorney, we all know, this particular one or this handful of them are problem kids, we'll call them. But you come against one of us, you come against all of us. It's kind of that's what it's looked like historically.
Yes.
And so that's a problem. That's a real problem. And I think if you have an independent prosecutor that doesn't have to rely on those folks day in and day out, then you take that out of the equation.
Is that enough? Is it enough to basically say we're going to have independent prosecutors out here who will go after police officers, and that somehow that's going to be enough to expect that they're going to be of the standard that we would demand of law enforcement?
Absolutely not. No, it takes much, much more than that. And I just want to make one thing really clear. A lot of people listening to this might say, yeah, you got these two defense guys on here. Of course, they're saying all this bad stuff about the cops. I am not anti-police. I do not support getting rid of police departments. I do not support defunding the police. But what I do support wholeheartedly is good policing. Look, police officers do stuff every single day that none of us regular folks want to do. Here's an example. You got an active shooter. I'm going the opposite way. I'm running away from the shooter. Good police officer going toward the shooter.
Wait, isn't that what Donald Trump said when he said he would run into the school? Something like that?
Well, and sometimes that's really true. I mean, sometimes that is really true. That's the type of stuff that good police officers do.
Right.
The other thing that they do is day in and day out, they're dealing with situations that a lot of times we don't even know about. Why don't we know about them? Because we don't have to deal with them. Why don't we have to deal with them? Because they do. But here's where there's a big rub that has been ignored for far too long. We put these people in these situations. We expect them to do all of these things to handle problems that none of the rest of us want to handle. And frankly, a lot of them I'm not going to handle. I can't speak for anybody else, but I think the average citizen says, I'm not going to do that. And we don't provide them with good training. We don't provide them with adequate support in terms of how to process a lot of the things that they have to deal with. And we expect that they just show up every day and continue to do that. And it doesn't work. Let's look at it from this perspective. If you look at the type of training and support that a local police department or local police officers would get, and you compare that to what federal agents get, it's night and day difference. Local police, if they go through the academy, they get a little bit of skills training, how to shoot guns and deal with handcuffs and apprehend people, and maybe a little bit on how to interrogate. But that's about the extent of it. They don't get any training on how to process trauma and how to process grief and all those other things that show up. And instead, what happens is they go out, for example, they go on a suicide call, or they go out on a call where a baby's been killed, or they go out on a bad domestic, and they deal with this stuff, and they just have to process it the best way they can, and usually that means they stuff it, right? And it never gets dealt with. Well, when you stuff it for so long, pretty soon it's going to show up. It's going to either show up in the cop doing something crazy on the street, or it's going to show up with the police officer drinking or doing drugs, or, you know, they take that stuff home with them too. So now we got problems in the home. All those things start to happen, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Rick, thank you so much for taking the hour with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me. This has been a very good and a very important conversation.
Fantastic. Rick Petrie. Again, he currently serves as the Assistant Director of the Career and Professional Development with Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. But we've been talking about this issue of where law enforcement goes. Stay with us. There's a lot more coming up. Again, this is my first hour. A lot more happening. My name is Jack Rice, filling in for Matt McNeil just for today and maybe another day somewhere down the road. Stay with us. A lot more coming up on AM 950. This is AM 950. Jack Rice in for Matt McNeil. And thanks for joining me for this first hour as we've been discussing law enforcement and the criminal justice system. You know, one of the things we were talking about was this idea of the rule of law, the idea that people would buy in and believe. And if they don't buy in, what does that do to society? And it's a critical question. And I think about this not just because of the work that I've done as a former prosecutor, as a criminal defense lawyer, but I've taught this issue all over the world. So whether I was in Republic of Georgia or we were in Russia or whether it was in Uganda or whether I was teaching in Kenya or other parts of the world as well, and you're trying to convince people and work with people and work with prosecutors and work with defense attorneys to work with a system that applies equally to all. And I can tell you, if you have a system that's fragmented, if you have a system where large swaths of society simply don't buy in, and more people simply refuse to buy in because the system is gamed against them, what you will see, and I'm telling you, what you will see is a disintegration of that society. Am I suggesting we're there? I'm suggesting that there are more and more people who have seen this, who have felt this, and who are acknowledging it now. And that is what is critical. If we can't embrace this issue and realize that we're about more, that we can't be better, then we face the very real problems that others around the world have faced too. We are not unique. Yes, we can be better. Yes, we should be better. Stay with me. A lot more coming up. My name is Jack Rice. I'm in for Matt McNeil on AM 950. This is AM 950, the Matt McNeil Show. You can tell I'm not Matt. Jack Rice in sitting in the big chair for at least today, just filling in, really. Matt's on vacation. He's on assignment, as the parlance, I guess, goes. But I'm with you for the next hour, and it's pretty great. I have to tell you, it's pretty great to be back in studio, sitting back in this chair. Again, I've been doing this for many years here at AM 950 and just happening to come in. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've been home for a year plus, just like you. Starting to work back in courtrooms again, And just like you've been walking back into work, I'm in a suit with a shirt and tie on right now. And it's just because I walked out of a courtroom right before I came over here to go in studio. But, you know, one of the other things I've been doing when I can figure out how to get on and watch some of it is I've been watching the Olympics. I know. This may be a throwback, but go with me for just a second. I want you to think about what this means. Because for me, I have to think about the Olympics in a different way. So stay with me for just a moment. I was a boy, and I remember sitting on the living room floor with a greenish shag carpet next to my brother. So we're laying on our bellies watching Mark Spitz. I'm taking you way back. Some of you may not even know. Breaks my heart. Bless you. I think it's 1968. I'm a little boy, okay? Something, maybe 72. I'm not even sure, but I'm very young. And we're watching this thing, and this is how it actually worked, is we would watch my brother, who was a sports fanatic, would watch anything having to do with any competition of any kind. So the idea of watching the Olympics for him is completely over the top. The idea that it's this person versus that, it's this country versus that. Of course, the idea that if I get to watch the East German luge team, you're going to realize that now we're talking about a team and what that might mean. Trust me. And me, I'm the younger brother, and I'm watching this all for sort of the storyline, the backstories. I'm the backstory guy watching this, trying to see what it all means. The story of sort of the sacrifice that this person goes through in order to actually get here and what that means. And so I'm chasing that story. He's chasing the competition to the point that it's Sunday afternoon, Olympics or otherwise. And if there is bowling on as a boy, my brother is watching it. Yeah. There's no backstory to bowling, by the way. That's my line, and I'm sticking to it. But as I watched the Olympics now, it got me thinking. And I thought about this because I had a long conversation with my youngest daughter, my youngest of four, who's a brilliant kid because she educates me. She teaches me. She explains things to me. And that's a good thing. If you're going to be a progressive, heck, if you're going to be a conservative, from my perspective, the purpose is to learn and to expand and to understand what you're doing. Now, as I think about the Olympics, this is the part that really comes to mind for me. If we look at the Olympics as it applies to gender, and we look at the future, and we look at what that means, explain this to me. And this is one of the issues that I think is really difficult for some people to get their heads around. If we look back and we look at the idea of the separation of men versus women, I think there's a lot of people who would say this is an anachronism. This is ridiculous. The distinction is not as clear, and it's not. The idea of what makes gender is not clear, or it's very clear depending upon who you are, correct? But if we look back historically, at the insanity in terms of how the Olympic Committee actually determined what makes somebody a man versus a woman, they originally started with literally a physical look. And they would sometimes actually look, which is horrifying, until they finally made a decision to stop this in the 60s or so. Subsequently, they made a decision. And that decision was about chromosomes. They said, oh, we're going to use chromosomes. But the problem with this is that we now know, and it became very clear not that long ago, and actually even several decades ago, that it's not as simple as one would think. Yes, I remember as a child the idea of saying, oh, well, what a man is the XY chromosome. What is a woman is an XX chromosome. I'm sorry. The problem is that's not accurate either. And what we know from science, and yes, I choose to embrace it, although some in the country do not, is that that's not how it works. The idea that some people can be an XXXX and maybe a Y. Sometimes an X will turn on, sometimes it doesn't. You can have multiple Ys. You can have a whole series of different distinctions. And the problem is you cannot make a difference. You cannot necessarily tell based upon that what somebody's gender is. So for a very long time, they thought they would use chromosomes. But the problem is that simply is inaccurate too, potentially, for a lot of different reasons. So in fact, what they did is they stopped it. The Olympic Committee made a decision that they weren't going to do that. They weren't going to use chromosomes anymore, and that was simply not appropriate. Then they started to use something else. And this is really recent. And this is very recent. This was the idea of using hormones. That's right. They would make a decision that based upon hormones, that's how they would decide what makes a man versus what makes a woman. The problem that comes with that is that even that they're finding is simply inaccurate. So essentially, according to the experts, this is what they have determined. And now they're backing away from this issue. The idea is that it's testosterone. Testosterone as a hormone is what is the distinction, one of that distinguishing factors that they will use to decide what makes a man versus a woman. And this is a critical issue if what you have done is you have created races, if you've created these various competitions that place you in one pot versus another pot, for lack of a better word, right? But the problem that comes with that simply doesn't end there, because it doesn't. What we have found is that with something like testosterone, they will say, and this is what according to what some of the scientists are telling us, is that typically testosterone found, quote unquote, in men will be anywhere between 10 times and up to 3, maybe even as high as 5,000 times naturally. That's the standard line. But here's our problem. What happens to the situation where you have somebody who is born, quote unquote, a woman, raised, quote unquote, a woman, identifies, quote unquote, as a woman, but has 11 times or 10 times and they're right on the bubble, if you will? Now what you get is somebody who the Olympic Committee will turn around and say, oh, this person has too much natural testosterone to therefore be considered a woman and can't go into that, as I said earlier, pot. So you have to go into the other side of that, which what happens if you get the man who identifies as a man, has grown up as a man, who sees themselves as a man, puts themselves out as a man in every sense, except for they're at 9 times. Now all of a sudden they have to go to the other side, right? So you will say, okay. And this is where my daughter comes in, by the way. I bring this in because this is how my daughter, she says, this is why I hate the Olympics. This is why this is idiocy. And this all needs to go away. Fight the patriarchy. I mean, it's magnificent. So that's what she does. And her response is that. And I said, okay. And she won't let me get through this overall analysis because she wants to knee-jerk grab me by the throat and throttle me because she thinks it's so stupid for a lot of reasons. But what happens? What happens when you're in that situation where you have a race that's of women versus men, meaning women are running a particular race. And for instance, there have been circumstances where there might be, and I listened to an interview with one of the fastest women on the planet. And what she said, in fact, gold medal, world champion, and what she said was that there are good high school boys who can run faster than she can. That's right. That's what she said, right? In terms of speed, in terms of their ability. And one of those reasons is because of testosterone, which, by the way, actually increases muscle mass, bone mass, a bunch of other things that gives speed naturally. And what happens is if that's the case and you said, well, let's just get rid of this distinction between males and females and say, let's just run, let's just swim, let's just do this. And enough of the distinctions, because they mean nothing, they are meaningless. And what you have is you could realize that the top 1,000 people who are racing, the top 1,000, it might even be higher than that, every single one of them would be considered, if you will, scientifically, and I use that term loosely, a man, which could very well mean that any woman who wants to compete would not be allowed to, would be incapable of competing because they can't compete at that level. And so that's the difficulty when you turn around and you say, how do you race something like this? How do you make the distinction? How do you decide what makes a man, what makes a woman? And I think about this in terms of the LGBTQ plus community, but also about transgender people and how they're moving and their identities, which are as real as any other. And you say, how do you embrace this? And is this something that can be embraced at all? Or is it simply something that is so foreign from one another that you have to create a line that no one can cross? It's a weird question to me because as I think about the Olympics, again, being that little boy laying in the shag carpet, watching it with my brother, and I think about the challenges that people at all levels have faced and struggled with when it comes to their ability, when it comes to their identity, when it comes to who they are, when it comes to what they're trying to accomplish. The question then becomes, is it a distinction that is an anachronism? Is it a distinction that needs to go away? And if it goes away, doesn't that mean the ability of some people to compete, specifically sometimes women who can't compete because of specific physiology, does that deny them the rights that they so rightfully deserve? I think about what that means, but I think of it in this broader sense too. I think of some of the work that I've done worldwide, and I think about where I have worked all over the world, whether that was in Russia, whether that was in Republic of Georgia, whether I was in Thailand working on some things, whether I was in South Sudan, any place, and you think about the ability of people who are just trying to compete because this is what makes their lives worthy for them. Do you simply deny them the right, the ability to do that? Because they don't fit into the bucket that you create. It's a tough question, but it's just one that I think about as I watch these Olympics and I cheer for people because I want to see people who come from everywhere succeed. It's all I've been thinking about. Stay with us. My name is Jack Rice, and I'm thrilled to be sitting in for Matt McNeil this day and maybe a couple of days in the future as we talk about the world, about politics, about how it all fits together, about what it all means. And we will actually take some phone calls coming up on some other issues too. So stay with us. A lot more coming up right here on AM 950. Sometimes I just like to listen to it. Right here on AM 950, Jack Rice with you for the Matt McNeil Show. Just for today, just hanging with you for a couple of hours as we look at what's going on in the world, what it means. You know, I walked into a courtroom today, and one of the things that has to happen in Minneapolis and St. Paul now is when you're walking into government buildings, you have to have a mask on again. And having worn this for a year, well, for a year plus, really, and then walking into court again today and having that back on again when you have this respite, this little window of time when you can peel it off and we're all walking around like nothing has happened. At first, sort of the knee jerk that this is crazy, and then all of a sudden you're used to it again, and now you're having to step back into the world with your face wrapped up. And we think about what that means. And we think about the laws that is as it applies and whether or not it's appropriate, whether or not it's fair, because I think one of the things we've tried to talk about, and I know that we've all been thinking about what this means, is how do we move forward from this? Is this what we are now? Is this who we are now? Why don't you join the conversation at 952-946-6205? That's 952-946-6205 here on AM 950. As we talk about whether or not where we are with COVID, where we are with this pandemic, that this is just where we're going, that this is just what it means. No matter what happens, is if it's going to be we have this vaccine and it works, but we have 40% of the yahoos have decided that science no longer exists, that they are now experts in HIPAA, that they understand medical technology far more than any doctor ever did because they can read Facebook. Therefore, they know the answer, so they can't get this vaccine. And what does that do to all of us as those variants are created? What does that do to all of us for those of us who may not be lucky enough to actually go out and get a vaccine because we have other immune deficiency issues. We have children who aren't old enough to get vaccines, and we have variants that are now starting to roll from people who were 75 once, who are now 35, who are getting them, catching these variants at 35 or 25 or less. That's the question. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Is this where we are? David, thanks for being on hold so long. What do you think?
Oh, how are you, Jack? You know, it's been over a year ago that my 11-year-old nephew went back to school down in Homestead, Florida, and brought it home to the whole family. So my brother and wife and all of the other kids in the family came down with it. So, you know, the idea that kids can't catch it is preposterous. And but the big lie keeps on rolling. I'm calling you from San Francisco, where we have not lost but one person, I believe, in the last month. But Kevin McCarthy's district, they're losing about one person a day. And so it's, you know, it's just pitiful.
But David, I mean, one of the problems that we face is that, and I get this, there's the part of me that thinks to myself, what I really want to do is I want to wall up Tennessee. I want to wall up Florida. I want to wall up Alabama and elsewhere, too, or maybe counties, and whether some of those might actually be here in Minnesota, too. But the problem that we all face is the nature of humanity. The nature of who we are is we are social animals. And because of airlines and because of cars and because of technology, we roll through, as you've just described, Florida when I'm in Florida or when I'm in California or when I'm in New York or when I'm in Amsterdam. The problem is that one person can touch 4 million in about 10 seconds.
Well, that's right. And you remember Edgar Allan Poe? He's probably, 150 years ago, he wrote The Mask of the Red Death, where the king looks out the parapet and looks down below to the squalor in the village below, and that they've got an epidemic in there in the streets. So he slams the door on the castle and refuses to allow the peasants in, but the Red Death makes his way into the party. And, you know, from the start, the knowledge that big money will get you killed. Big money will get you killed, especially when they say get back to work and ignore an epidemic. And that's where DeSantis is, and that's where the governor, I see by the headlines today, the governor of Arkansas is taking back, just a week ago, he was making it against the law to wear a mask in the state of Arkansas. And, you know, there's an example of big money will get you killed. He was thinking that he was going to be a rich and famous governor, but he sure enough got his own people killed by doing it, and he's taking it back. And I was going to ask you, as an attorney, you know, that self-defense has been a legitimate defense for for centuries, so probably Blackstone's Law, right? And so the idea that people like the governor of Missouri, the governor or the attorney general of Missouri, making it challenging that St. Louis can't have a mask mandate. The governor of Arkansas, the governor of Texas, the governor of Florida, all saying it's against the law to do a mask mandate. So they're basically saying that it's against the law to save your own life. Hmm. It's against the law. Self-preservation is against the law.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, David, and it's a great question. And I think about that issue. By the way, join the conversation at 952-946-6205. As we think about the pandemic and COVID and where we take this in the future, whether it's with us in the future, or whether this is just who we are now. When I think about it, David, what I think about is this, is that there is a law in place as it applies to somebody who goes out into society and spreads a disease. And sometimes you will have that with people with sexually transmitted diseases. If you don't notice somebody on something, if you don't notice them that you have this thing, and this has happened in other parts of the country as well. If you had a sexually transmitted disease, if you had AIDS, if you had something like that, that you are obligated to let somebody know if you're going to be intimate with them in some way that you have this and that it's actually a crime if you don't. And if you think of that logic, right, if you think of the idea that I know I have something, I walk out into the world and I simply spread it because I can, should you not be liable for it? And the answer seems, if it's consistent with that, the answer should be yes, or at least I want to feel like it's yes, right? I mean, I certainly want that to happen. And I think part of it for all of us is this, for those of us who stayed home as long as we did, the financial sacrifices, the personal sacrifices, my daughter going to school in her room every single day for day after day after day after day, all of these things that were done, all of the things that we lost, all of the people that we have lost. And yet what happens is that there will be the others who simply decide, oh, either I'll let the herd, meaning I'll let everybody else pick up my trash, because I have decided I'm not in the mood, or what will happen instead is, well, all of these things will happen. All of these things will be taken care of, and then I will be just fine. Or maybe the worst of all, which is, I don't care. I don't care what happens to you. I don't care what happens, because it's all a vast conspiracy as we bury our own, as we try to convince our kids that the world will come back in some way or another, that their lives will be on track, that they will be able to see their grandparents, or they will be able to see their friends, or they will be able to see their classmates or their teachers. I mean in person, right? I don't mean on Zoom, but I mean in person. If you can do something like that, how do you handle, David, how do you handle those kinds of people? How do you address the people who don't care at all? And if we think about exactly the situation in Arkansas, we realize that this wasn't the only governor who started to acknowledge these issues. And what you're seeing is the idea of what happens when you take something that is objectively true. A disease is objectively true. A virus is objectively true. It is what it is. And what you decide to do with it is you decide to turn it into a political club. And I don't mean club as in let's go to the club. I mean, if you turn it into a club to beat on an opponent, rather than recognize that there are some things that are above the fray. There are some things that are above politics, of right, of left, of Republicans, of Democrats. But what you've decided is I can use this to hurt Democrats. And so therefore my goal, and I choose not to use the name of the man, my goal is to use this to buttress my party and to diminish the opposing party and blame them for anything and everything, or to belittle them by saying, ooh, they're afraid of everything, and so therefore, this is not that big a deal. And yet, the cost that we are seeing to society continues. you look at where we are with this pandemic and what we are seeing with variants. And now as we talk about the idea, as I just did several days ago with a couple of nurses on this issue, who basically started talking about, and we've seen this with the experts, talking about the need for a booster because of what is out there and because of the limitations of the virus itself, but of the variants that are coming at us, the desperate need to continue to protect ourselves and even increase the protections that we have, because there are those of us in society who've decided they aren't in the mood, or they've decided that science is a conspiracy. Let me tell you one thing. This is the one thing about that science is a conspiracy piece that I have to tell you. It was only a couple of years ago that I was working in South Sudan. We're in the middle of a civil war going on in the country. There's more than 400,000 dead in South Sudan, and this is just a recent count. And I'm up in northwestern South Sudan, and I'm in the midst of dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have polio. If you don't know what polio looks like, if you don't know what polio does to your body, and if you're older, you may remember this from maybe parents, maybe grandparents, maybe friends when this was an issue in the United States, and you think that vaccines are simply, quaint. Is that a word we want to go with? That this is just something else? Walk into South Sudan with me as you look into the eyes of a child with polio. And then you tell me that this is something that you can choose to do or not, because we've heard that it may cause something by some actor who learned about it on the internet and then everybody else follows. Now we're talking. Stay with us. We have a lot more coming up right here on the program. And again, you can join us at 952-946-6205. That's 952-946-6205. My name is Jack Rice. I have been with you for, years in the past here at AM 950, but at least for a little while longer. I'm sitting right here in the big chair. This is Matt's chair, and he'll certainly be back, but I got it for a little longer right here on AM 950. This is AM 950, the Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice with you. Thanks for joining the program. Thanks for being with me for the last couple of hours. You know, as I sort of wrap this up, as we move forward, you know, one of the issues that the Biden administration is struggling with, just like every administration has frankly struggled with in the United States, certainly since 2001, but you could probably go back further, would have to do with Afghanistan. And with what that means, because here's what we know. And what we know is this, is that the U.S. is, yes, pulling out of Afghanistan. But what they claim, by the way, and this is what they claim, is that they are not ready to throw in the towel in Afghanistan as talks continue with the Taliban. I can tell you, as I think back to conversations I have had, as I think back to history, here is one of the problems that we face. No one has ever taken Afghanistan. Nobody. We can go back and look at the Brits. They tried twice. We know that the Russians have tried multiple times, most recently back in the late 70s, and they failed dismally. We can look at Genghis Khan. That was a failure. Alexander the Great, that was a failure. And the U.S. moving in could build a country, thinking they could help bind Afghanistan back together. I recall being in Western Afghanistan back in 2009, I think, and close to the Iranian border, sitting down with a colonel from the 82nd Airborne as he looked me in the face and said, "There is no more difficult place on the planet to fight a mechanized war than Afghanistan. It simply is not." If we think of the difference, this is one of those pieces that came to mind for me, and this is something that always sticks with me when you think of the difference between Afghanistan and other places. I think of Iraq. I compare Iraq to Afghanistan. Here's what I can tell you. If I'm in Baghdad, I can reach down and pick up a handful of sand, and it'll run through my fingers. If I'm in Afghanistan, and I reach down and I pick up a handful of sand, and I squeeze it, I open it up, and that ball will still be there. This is why it's substantially important, far more important. The nature of what we see there is that it's so fine that it gets in every, dare I say it, nook and cranny, every crevice. It gets into every piece of machinery, and we cannot stop it. There's another problem. The problem with Afghanistan is it has never been a cohesive country, ever. The way that it is organized, the way that it is has been established for millennia, is that it's tribal in nature. And anybody who's tried to say, this is Afghanistan, I can tell you being in Kandahar, I can tell you being in Kabul, I can tell you being on the Hindu Kush, I can tell you wherever I am, no matter who I'm talking to, if you ask somebody who they are, if you ask them what they are, they will not say they are Afghan. They are not Afghanistan. They are not from Afghanistan. They are from their tribe. They are from maybe their region. And that is simply the truth. And yet, I have to tell you, I have dear friends of mine, again, soldiers, Marines, others, intelligence officials, who have worked in this country desperately trying to make this work, desperately trying to bring this country together. But here's our problem. The problem in the end is that no place in the world is in isolation anymore. Something, as I've said before many years ago, something that can happen in a cave in southern Afghanistan is something that can reach all the way to New York City. It is just the truth. But history doesn't change either. So if we think about the U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan, as they are continuing to figure out how to do that, despite the fact that the Biden administration, just within the last 5 hours, has talked about this issue, the problem is history doesn't change either. If you think about the Russians pulling out of Afghanistan, this was 40 years ago. It seems shocking to me that that's the case, but there you have it. The problem is that the U.S. decisions to push the Russians out are one of the very same decisions that resulted in sucking the Americans in. The very people that the U.S. recruited, trained, motivated, fed, paid, and then drove from Pakistan up through the Khyber Pass, up into Afghanistan, those very people are the very people right now who are driving into Kandahar and Kabul and the surrounding countryside and taking over the cities and pushing out the government of Afghanistan that we have spent billions and billions and billions of dollars to build. The very people who we trained, or their children, or their grandchildren, are the very ones who are fighting us now. That's the undeniable truth and the undeniable fact of what happens. As we look back at this and we think about this, and I realize, understand, here's what happens. When we talk about what's going on in the world, until something big happens in the United States and then everything drops off. So here is the example of what I mean by that, is that once COVID hit here, not when it hit in Italy, not when it hit in Spain, not when it hit in Wuhan, China, but when it hit in New Jersey, and when it hit in Kansas, and when it hit in Minneapolis, and when it hit in San Diego, then all of a sudden, everything else in the world dropped off. Everything else in the world sort of goes into the hinterlands, right? It just seems to go away. And we're focused in on this issue, and we forget about everything else that matters in the world because we see it as inconsequential or less consequential. True, right? Less consequential. But the problem that comes with that is that those issues matter. And those issues can impact where we're going in the future. And that's one of the reasons, as we look at the Afghanistan question or the Iraq question or so many other questions that we have, and we think about what happens when we've decided, as we did during the last administration, to throw enormous sums of money at the U.S. Army, at the Pentagon, at the Marine Corps, at the Navy, etc. We do this, and what it does is it creates a power base. It creates the ability to reach out and respond in the world in a way that doesn't impact us here. So we don't feel the pain. We don't feel the pain of what it is that's going on in the world because we're so separated from it that we're almost isolated from our own decisions. So we see things happening and we don't recognize that it can impact us as it is. And I think that's one of our problems. And we think about Afghanistan, obviously, and one of those pieces. This is the truth when it comes to so many other regions of the world. One of the biggest we have right now and one of the struggles that we have right now is what's going on with China and why we're struggling as we are, as China continues to sort of flex their muscles and they're creating this space on a world stage and as they're doing this in the South China Sea. And they are, by the way. And what the Americans are trying to do and what that means and how we simply can't respond to it. And if we do, the decisions that we make and the mistakes that we make will plague us as a result. I'm going to turn to Brad in Robbinsdale. Brad, you've been on hold for a long time. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Okay. I just want to correct, the claim that Afghanistan has never been conquered. That is actually incorrect. I mean, in the last maybe 2,000 years, Afghanistan has been conquered and administered by dozens of different political units, including the White Huns, the Ilkhan, and probably one of the most notable is the Kushan Empire of the 3rd and 4th century, which commanded the trade routes between China and Rome, East Africa, and India. And they were incredibly wealthy, and they ruled from their capital of Kandahar. And in particular, I actually saw an exhibit at the National Museum in Washington, D.C., of their artifacts, and I have never seen so much gold in one place. So, again, throw them on a historical note. They have been just administered and, you know, ruled dozens of times by dozens of different, units.
Well, thank you, Brad, and I appreciate it. I think we would disagree only in the sense that when you think about Afghanistan as a whole, what I'm talking about is a collective country with an identity that sees themselves as an Afghanistan. And see, that's part of the problem, because I can take you to the north when you have very particular tribes, and then you have tribes to the south that actually have as much animosity towards one another as they do towards anybody else. And collectively, while they were able to take certain aspects, whether it was Kandahar all the way across Herat and then to the west, what you don't get is this collective identity that somehow you have a country that defines itself as such and can keep itself going as a whole. And the problem, what we're seeing, and as everybody else has seen, is anybody who tries to take it, while you can maintain it for a period of time, in the end, it breaks itself to pieces because it doesn't see itself as a whole, and it's never collectively, ultimately been the whole that the U.S., the Brits, the Russians, and others have continued to try to make it into, despite all efforts. But this is what history is about, and we have to think about what this means, because if we don't, again, dare I say it, the mistakes that we made, we will make again. Stay with us. Have a few more minutes left. Sitting in the big chair. This is Jack Rice sitting in for Matt McNeil. He'll be back in a little while, but I'm here at least for another few minutes right here on AM 950. You're listening to AM 950, the voice of Minnesota. This is Jack Rice in for Matt McNeil. And again, thanks for being with me for the last couple of hours as we look at the world. Now, we spent the first hour really looking, not really at the Derek Chauvin case. It was really about sort of us. It was about who we are, where we're going, the idea of the criminal justice system, and which is what I deal with every day on a daily basis as I'm dealing with this case, individual people who've been charged with crimes or dealing with the criminal justice system in the broader sense. The thing is that sometimes people will look at it and they will see it as this thing in the distance that's not about them. It's sort of about other people. They can say, oh, it's about bad guys, or it's about these guys or those people, or about the police, or whether they're good police or bad police, or whether we should fund them or not fund them. Those are all questions that are legitimate ones, by the way. But the thing is what it's really about is about this. It's about the belief that the system works or doesn't. And that is critical. It's critical because if we can't buy in, if we can't believe this, if we simply think that it doesn't matter, what you will get is swath after swath of people, chunk after chunk of society that will simply pull back and it will start to break up. And we're seeing it now. We're seeing large groups. By the way, this includes politically speaking. If you're saying the system doesn't work or it's a lie, what you get is this disintegration, which causes incredible instability, which creates its own instability. And so if we think about systems and we think about the law, we think about politics, we think about criminal justice, we are living in a situation right now where there are large groups of people who think that the system is so broken that you might as well not even buy in. Or worse, you're willing to storm the Capitol in order to overturn it because it doesn't reflect your reality. If we don't start to see that disintegration and acknowledge it and come together and find that common ground, this is the beginning of that end. This is the 476 and Gibbon's Rome comes to pass. Again, a modern Rome. We've been called that in the past. Thanks for being with me for the last couple of hours. Again, my name is Jack Rice. I've been thrilled to be with you. Just to embrace where we are and to talk about where we're going. Matt will certainly be back, but I'll be back again right here on AM 950.